still flashing.
Uh-huh. Now it's recording. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. December 11th, 2012, in Berlin, at the Winter Simulation Conference 2012. We're here to interview Jack Klein from Tilburg University in the Netherlands. I'm Bob Sargent from Syracuse University. We'll be doing interviewing along with Jim Wilson from North Carolina State University. And so we're going to discuss a little bit about Jack's career, and then we're going to discuss about some of the early history and personalities and contributions that were made. So I think we'll start off with Jack asking where you went to college and how you got your degrees and where at. And
yeah,
if you could do that, please.
Okay, so I did all my studies in Tilburg University. And all means bachelor's, master's, and PhDs, and then became an assistant associate and full professor, and then I'm about to retire from Tilburg University in 1 year as a part-time professor. So going back to the start, as a master's student in Tilburg in the operations research, that was my field. You had to do fieldwork of two months. And the fieldwork that I did actually was my first exposure to simulation of a kind. And when I say of a kind, I mean that at that time we didn't have computers. We were just introducing computers, because the fieldwork I did was at the blast furnaces in a town called IJmuiden near Amsterdam. And the company was called Hoogovens, which is Dutch word for blast furnaces. Was later on merged with British Steel, and then taken over by Tatra Steel. And I still think it's in the hands of Tatra Steel and still working. So the problem I was looking at was how many ingots, I think is the technical term. It's like when kids are playing at the beach, you fill in the sand in a form. And so instead of sand, they used molten steel, and they put it in a form. But you have different kinds of form if you can watch at the beaches. And the question is how many of different forms you need for the steel production. And that was a complicated problem. It involved inventory control and also queuing analysis, I think. And so after 2 months, I was at the stage that I understood the problem, and I saw that the solution would require simulation. I don't think I had ever, I'm sure I had never practiced simulation. I wonder whether I had read about simulation, because we used, for operations research, we did not use Wagner's book with simulation as the last chapter. We used Churchman, Eckhoff, and Arnoff. And I don't remember. Oh, simulation was in that book.
It was mentioned, but there wasn't much on it.
There was not much on it. It was about this drunkard looking under the lamppost for his keys he lost, and then he had the random walk simulation. That's as far as I remember. So anyhow, we decided that simulation might give the answer, and I developed a flow chart of how to write the simulation. But since we had no computers, it was just had bought the computer, and my supervisor at this company was taking his first classes in computer technology. So that was my master's degree. And after that, I graduated as a master's degree. And in the Netherlands, just like in Britain, I learned today, that was enough to start an academic career. And hardly anybody thought about getting a PhD. I think our professors basically all had PhDs. But I would have to double check that. Anyhow, so I started as what we would now call an assistant professor. And then I got my second exposure to simulation, because we had a visiting professor from Delft University. And he gave several talks on how to simulate queuing problems, especially in the context, in the application area of telephone systems. Because he worked for the Dutch, he also worked part-time for the Dutch company responsible for our telephone system, or Bell, big Bell. So he gave his lectures, but as an assistant professor, I had a supervisor, and his name was Professor Max Euwe. He was a mathematician by education. He was world famous for being the world chess champion at the end, just before World War II. So he was Max Öber was actually the only person of Dutch origin known in the Soviet Union. Nobody knew the name of our queen, but everybody knew the name of our chess, because he worked together with Botvinnik on the problem of, can computers ever play chess? And Max Öber, my professor, said no. And Botvinnik said yes. And they got money from the predecessor of the European community to explore this problem. And after 20 years, it turned out that Botvinnik, and also Soviet Union chess player, not a world champion, I think, Botvinnik was right, Max Öber was wrong. So Max Öber was a mathematician and a chess player, and he didn't understand all this stochastic and statistical stuff of computer simulation. So he asked me, why don't you teach simulation next year, a course, an introductory course to simulation? And
that was year what, approximately?
That must have been, let's see, 1970? No, earlier, much earlier. So I graduated master's degree in 64, I think, so it must have been 66, something like that. Because I know that then the next step was I went to UCLA in 67 for 1 year. And that was my serious, I had been teaching simulation, that was pretty serious. So I did probably some basic queuing stuff. I don't remember the details, but I went to UCLA. And because I had this exposure to simulation, I thought I had to select a number of classes to fill a year. So I took a course in discrete event simulation taught by Clay Sprouls. He was a full professor at UCLA in the Graduate School of Business. And he had just discovered this great book. We had to rush to the bookstore at UCLA, and it was Naylor, Balinfi, Burdick, and Chu. And he taught his whole course from that book. We had also to do take a test, but also write a paper. And I wrote a paper on common random numbers and antistatic variates. And this professor, he liked the paper. And there was another professor involved, Ross Nelson from the same school. And he recommended to me to submit this paper to Management Science. And it got accepted by Management Science and published. It was also Ross Nelson who suggested that I would talk to people at the RAND Corporation, at the RAND Corporation, who really know about this stuff. And that was George Fishman and Phil Kiviat. I think Phil was more in the simulation languages department.
And modeling, yeah.
And modeling. And George Fishman was in spectral analysis, I remember. And so I talked to these guys for an afternoon. And then I had to go back to the Netherlands. But I got a telegram. We didn't have internet at that time. It's hard to imagine you have no internet. I never used a telephone. It was too expensive. So by the way, my daughter was born at UCLA. But we didn't call home to tell that my daughter was born. We sent a telegram. Said it's a girl. Yeah. on the way back to Europe, I stopped for 1 or 2 weeks at Duke University and visited Tom Naylor, who was the author, remember, of that textbook we used. And that contact was nice. So Tom Naylor invited me to come back for 3 months the next year. I did that. And then the year after that, I went back again, I think. And we worked on multiple ranking procedures. Probably the idea was Tom's. And I worked together with Tom Wannicott, of the Wannicott and Wannicott famous brothers in econometrics. That was published in Management Science too. And so I was back home again. And now we are talking about 1975, 74. No, I'm going too fast. It's around 1970. And I decided to start writing a book on these things, like multiple ranking and variance reduction techniques and experimental design, all statistics. And the publisher was an old friend of my supervisor, Max Öber, Marcel Dekker, who had escaped from the Netherlands to the United States when the Germans, the Nazis, invaded the country. He was Jewish. So he was one of the last people who was rescued. He moved to New York. He used to work for Elsevier, his deck, and then he started his own company. My book got published in 74-75.
You had two volumes of that book.
It was two volumes, volume 1, 74, volume 2, 75. That got an honorable mentioning from the Lancaster Prize. That's the prize that ORSA, the predecessor of Informs, had. It was also translated into Russian in 1978 in Moscow. They actually had three Russian statisticians who did the translation, I understand. So that was...
Okay, let's talk about that book a little bit. What kind of impact do you think it had on the simulation community, say, in the United States as well as Europe? How was it received, and did it affect anything?
I think it was quite successful in the sense this prize was a formal recognition. Also, this book was quite expensive. It was over $200. And they sold 3,000 copies, I think, which by Deck was considered to be a big sales volume. It opened the doors, I think, for me personally in the United States. So I was invited to come to Bloomington Business School, for example. That's one of the things I remember, where I spent 3 months teaching stuff for my book. And I had never heard of Bloomington and of Clay Weiberg, my host. And he invited me to teach his course. I found out that the students in business school didn't know anything. They did a lot of simulation. They simulated everything, especially production planning stuff. But it was very poorly designed and very poorly analyzed. So I felt like a missionary spreading the word, you know. And I remember when they took the test, we had maybe 25 people. They all flunked. So then we decided to switch to a pass-fail system. So, and they all had been doing their utmost, you know, so they all passed the exam. That was also the time that I somehow got an invitation from Alan Pritzker to travel from Bloomington to Purdue to give a seminar. And I don't know how Alan Pritzker and I got into contact, because we didn't have the internet, so it must have been a letter or so. And so I drove up to Purdue, so where the doors were open probably through my book, and I was received by Alan Pritzker's premier PhD student, Jim Wilson. And they took me to the me and my family to a restaurant. It was dark. I think it was called the Silver Mine or so. And we had dinner there.
Mountain Jacks, I think it was.
What was it?
Mountain Jacks.
Mountain Jacks?
Yes, oh. It's still there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, later on I came back to Alan Pritzker when he had his own company. Because the first visit, he was a professor at Purdue. Then I came back when he had his company, and I taught a course for people from all over the United States, together with Lee Schrubin and Alan himself, but I did the major thing. That's why I was invited to flow over to Purdue. I went to Tom Naylor several times.
Okay, well, I sort of interrupted your time yesterday, but I was trying to get some feel for this book you turned out. So we got the impression now that it really got you recognized in the United States. So did it have any effect in terms of Europe or England in terms of... the field?
I should mention that. Oh, I forgot my PhD dissertation.
Yeah, I was hoping you might mention a PhD.
While I was writing the book, somebody said that it might be a good idea to write a PhD dissertation, and I decided that first chapter was just an introduction, second chapter I don't remember, and the third chapter was on variance reduction techniques. So I took that out of the book while the book was being produced, and Alan of Tucker in England was more or less a member of my committee. We didn't have the committee structure formally, but it was good habit to ask for opinions of other people. And I had met Tucker at a conference in London, and so probably my professor asked me, is there anybody in the world who could give an advice or an evaluation of your dissertation? Because remember, he himself was a mathematician, so the only contribution he had was on an appendix on random number generation, where he could supply the formal mathematical proofs of this conquential mode. And I had another supervisor, by the way, which was unusual, and he was from Delft. He was the guy who originally was my supervisor at this company, but he left the company, became a professor in Delft in applied operations research, and was the only professor without a PhD. So it was possible to be a professor without a PhD, but he had all this practical experience. But his knowledge of statistics was also virtually zero. So then I suggested to contact Tucker and send a copy of my dissertation, Chapter 3, and during the official defense, my supervisor wrote or read this a line from Tucker's evaluation, and he said he found the dissertation exhausting and exhaustive. So that was my contact with England. So there was some contact with England, and mainly with Stocker, I think. I didn't know Russell Cheng yet at that time. And Europe was, there was no European common market. And now we have a European common market, but we still have not a European academic single organization. I mentioned to some people today at the conference, you know, that we were talking about Krieging. I gave a talk about Krieging, and I mentioned that first-class work is right now being done in France, but nobody at the Winterstill knows about it, I'm pretty sure. And it's really top quality. And those people now, the French people slowly start erasing the language boundaries, and they are now publishing in English and technometrics, and that's, but traditionally, so it was very hard to communicate with France. Communications with Germany should have been easy. I had some contacts with people in Germany, Professor Mertens, he must have retired now. Scandinavia, I had some contacts with a guy in Sweden, I remember, Andreasson, who did first-class work in variance reduction technique, especially antisthetics. And that was in English. And I was even invited to come to Sweden to be a member of his
group. Well, you got some visibility with your book, I guess.
Yes.
All right, so maybe we should go back and talk about your history there. You're going through your history. You brought writing your book and got your PhD dissertation, and you've been to the United States and a couple times. But you also went, I think, to IBM or something, didn't you?
Yeah, that was in...
So we'll just continue your life history.
Yeah. So we basically were at my book, 74, 75. And I remember that I was working on my book while I was visiting IBM Research in San Jose. I spent a year with IBM Research. And I was tempted to continue this simulation stuff because Steve Lovenberg at IBM was deeply involved in things like control variance. I remember he had several publications on that. But before I left the country to join IBM, I decided to go for a different project that was on the quantification of the financial benefits of computer technology, which IBM thought would be a great idea, because at that time, 74, computers were handed over from the computer scientists to the business, to the managers. That was the idea. That was where the money was. But you had to convince the managers that it was worthwhile to buy one of these very, very expensive mainframes. We had no PCs. And so the idea of our project, we worked with three people, two people from Berkeley, or PhDs from Berkeley, and electrical engineering, and myself. We worked trying to quantify those benefits. So I stayed away from simulation. I tried, I did my best, but then they hired a consultant, IBM, during that year, and that consultant turned out to be Tom Naylor again. So back to Tom Naylor. I wrote a book on this project that was published by Addison Wesley. I returned. I worked on in this field for a couple of years, but I didn't like it too much. It was too soft science, you know, quantifying the benefits of computers. So I returned to simulation, or continued simulation. And I think, so what was my next book? It was probably the book published by Wiley in England, to get co-authored it with Willem van Groenendaal. Was called Simulation, a Statistical Perspective. So I'm typically the statistical perspective, not the computer languages. So I did some programming myself, but it was always in these old days in a general purpose language. To start with Fortran, that's what I used at Tilburg and at UCLA. At IBM, I did also my own programming. We did an APL, which at that time was a big hype,
yes.
APL. So it had the simulation flavor because I programmed the business game, and since we had no students to play the game, I developed a what we would now call an agent, and we called it a robot player at that time. And I programmed this, the robot in APL. So then I had the book with
well, you programmed it in the higher level languages now. You know, in England they have the activity scanning and three phase stuff. In America they have the event worldview. So what was you programming in higher level language? What kind of modeling or worldview did you use?
In the beginning I followed, I used the Tom Naylor's book, and it had all the flow charts in it. I don't think
it would be event worldview.
And so it would be the event. So I was brainwashed by Tom Naylor to look at the world in this way. And so I used that in my teaching for a long time. And then I added more and more notes, you know, to the Tom Naylor book, especially those parts where I thought I knew more than Tom Naylor, like common random numbers, antistatics. And then slowly that developed into a textbook, in first in Dutch, then in English. That was published by Wiley in the UK. And then, after a while, I decided that I should switch to Law and Kelton, because I sold only 3,000 copies or so, and Law and Kelton sold 80,000 or 70,000 copies at that time. So I decided to switch to Law and Kelton, and also to switch to Arena at the same. We did that at the same time.
Yeah. Well, so you used a bit. Well, I was just curious, you know, because of your European location, you know, the Netherlands, what they were doing. All right. So sorry to interrupt your history description here, but I was wanting to get that on record.
So the next book on simulation actually is a quite recent book, published in 2008, still the statistical aspect. It's called Design and Analysis of Simulation Experiments. And I had hoped that the acronym DAISY would catch on, but Design and Analysis of Simulation Experiments. And that was translated into Chinese a few years ago. So that was my latest book and probably my last book. I publish all these articles, you know, a few hundreds.
Well, do you think this latter book you wrote on design experiments stuff is to replace your two earlier volumes?
Yes, that was my idea, and to update it, especially I threw out things that I now find less interest. I threw out basically all the variance reduction techniques, my PhD's topic, because my experience was that in practice, I have a slightly practical orientation. The only technique people use is common random numbers, because it's the standard, the default option in Arena, and people use it without knowing they use it, which is dangerous in the analysis part. So I warn my students, be aware, if you don't do anything, you do common random numbers, and in the analysis you have to account for that. So I throw out the VRT. I maintain the response, the design aspect, but I also realize that if you select the design, before you select the design, you need a meta model.
Oh, what's a meta model? And where did that term come from?
So the meta model is a term that I think was first coined by a guy called Blanning in an article, probably in Interfaces or in Management Science. And it was a pretty vague idea that the simulation was so complicated that you should consider it as a black box. It has an input and output. And then I wrote an article, and that was part, and I called it I realized that when you do a regression analysis, actually, in the back of your mind, you have a linear regression model, i.e. you have a low-order polynomial, first or second-order polynomial. That's as high as we go. And once you decide on that meta model, you have to find an experimental design that enables you to come up with good estimates of the parameters of that regression model. So I kept that's still, I think, the most popular type of meta model nowadays, but you see that especially in deterministic simulation, that's a different world, but it's a related world in mechanical engineering, etc. People are not using polynomial models anymore, but Kriging models. That's getting very, very popular. So I invited somebody from that area to give a talk at the Winter SimLab maybe 10 years ago. That was a bit too early, but that's the way it goes. And it takes 10 years before ideas catch on. Like, I just come from a meeting on sequential bifurcation, and Peter Frazier was talking enthusiastic about SBs, sequential bifurcation. Well, that was the topic of one of my PhD students, and it took 10 years before it got recognition in the United States. So in the sequential bifurcation, by the way, I keep in my latest book and the design of experiments. I have also a chapter on the Kriging models or Gaussian process models. So my current research is mostly on Gaussian process models, or Kriging, I like to call it, which was developed by this South African mining engineer Daniel Krieger, who is now in his 90s. It was formalized mathematically by Matteron near Paris, in Fontainebleau. And that explains why there is such a strong school in France, because it's Matteron who's the founding father of Kriging in France. And I also have this, and I'm also working on sequential bifurcation. Even today, I have a Chinese PhD student, and we submitted an article. Actually, the second revision, or the first revision, will be submitted in a month or so, on sequential bifurcation extended to multiple outputs. Because in real life, that's what you have. You don't have a single output. The power of simulation, you have a variety of outputs. And we try to do a sequential bifurcation for that.
Okay, well, you have visitors come through too occasionally, so you might talk about a visitor or two that you had.
Visitor I still remember with pleasure, that was Bob Sargent. Bob visited me for 1 month. When was it?
I think it's a little longer.
Was it 2 months?
Two to three months,
okay,
yeah.
And when was that, Bob? Do you remember?
I don't know, it must have been back in the 80s or early 90s,
yeah.
Anyway.
And we were looking for a topic, and you had all your validation presentation at WinterSim. And so we decided to join forces, and we spent these months on validation of simulation models. We published it in the European Journal of OR, and I think it's a highly cited article if people want to give a quick reference for validation of discrete event simulation. That's their cited article.
Well, you probably had some other real important visitors too.
I had Reuven Rubinstein, who passed away. By the way, I found an email last night from the chairman of the department in Israel, the Technion, that Reuven had passed away the day before, December 9. I remember, because December 10 is my wedding anniversary. That was yesterday. Mm-hmm. Reuven visited me several times, and we worked on score function things. Michael Fu visited me for a month, and he gave courses on perturbation analysis. A guy who's more statistician, Del Castillo, I don't know if you know him at Penn State. He's a statistician.
What's his name again?
Del Castillo. He's originally from Mexico, but he's an American citizen now at Penn State. So he visited me for months. Russell Chang has visited me many times, and I visited Russell Chang, sponsored by the British Council and sponsored by NATO. And one of those visits, 1 month visit with Russell, resulted in this operations research article, which is still cited many times.
You've written several papers with Russell Chang.
I wrote several papers with Russell Chang, yeah. And Russell wrote also on sequential bifurcation, but all by himself. And we did some bootstrapping stuff. Actually, we had an article on how to use bootstrapping in the validation of discrete event models.
Yes.
And that was published in Management Science. And I have this nice memory. Yes, it's nearly like an anecdote. It was Russell Chang and Bert Bettenville, who by education was a statistician, and myself, and we were talking about bootstrapping. But bootstrapping is much like simulation, you know. It's a very powerful tool, but it gives you all the freedom to develop your model. That's nice, but that's also a danger. What should be the correct model? And so the three of us were discussing how you could use bootstrapping to validate the simulation model. And we had very different ideas, and we were very vigorously defending our worldview, you know. And I'm glad to say that as a non-statistician, I won the last battle, you know. Yeah, that's an interesting history, yeah. So, and then I had French visitors and some German visitors. Henri Pierval from France, I met him an hour ago. Helena Czabiczka from, she's Polish by birth, but she's teaching in Germany. At least, like the contact with Helena was, we had grand plans, you know, but some of those plans don't work out. Yeah.
So we spent a lot of time so far talking about yourself. So
yeah.
Why don't you talk about, you know, any of the fathers of simulation that you may know? You know, you mentioned Topper was on your PhD committee. So
yeah.
Do you have any comments to make about him or any other of these famous early people?
Well,
yourself?
I know you're
a child, but maybe
it's like an anecdote. You know that my first meeting with Topper was in around 1970, probably. I went to it was my second trip abroad. My first trip was, by the way, to Portugal to a NATO conference, and I nearly had developed an also interest because I was invited by Guy Orcutt to come to Wisconsin to work on micro-simulation, he called it. Are you familiar with micro-simulation in the book by Guy Orcutt?
No,
oh.
I'm not, no.
I've been working on that for the Dutch government. It means that you take a sample of people and you simulate the life of these individual people, and they might get married. I remember that in Orcutt's, he was especially interested in the population dynamics. Well, he was an economist, but you have a sample of men, a sample of women, and they, boys and girls, they might meet, they might marry, they might get children, and it's all probabilities. And at the end of your simulation run, you do a forecast for the population of the United States. You do a forecast for the employment rate, etc. And I did similar stuff in the Netherlands, only recently, like 10 years ago. But that was not typical for my discrete event activities. So I met Tucker, to answer your question, at this conference in London. And Tucker was a great speaker. The problem was he told jokes, it was a Yorkshire dialect, and I didn't understand the Yorkshire dialect, and neither did any of the Dutch people. We were about four or five people from Holland, you know, and all the Englishmen were having a big laugh, and we didn't understand the jokes. And then later on, like several years later, I got the British Council Travel Award, it was called. And I drove up, I took a train ride to Birmingham. I met him, and we spent a day together. A very nice, helpful guy, you know. He was working in industry at that time. So nowadays, these contacts would be much more intensive because we have the internet, you know, and we travel a lot. But in those days, when I went to the United States, you know, I was the only person at the whole university. And they said, and I had a colleague, for example, why would you travel to the United States? What can you learn in the U.S. that you cannot learn in the Netherlands? That was the attitude.
All right, so do you meet any other people in England, that, you know, any of the early simulation people, or in Europe, or...?
So we did not meet. We didn't travel. We lived in our own small countries, in our own language. That's a big difference with the United States, where you have a single big country, and it's quite easy for you to travel to UCLA, to go from West Coast to East Coast. And in the Netherlands and in Europe in general, we do not have that tradition. That's a major difference.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned earlier to me that before we started recording that there's no simulation society in the Netherlands, and that must have had an impact in terms of research and application. So would you give me your perspective on that?
Yeah, in Harvey Wagner, in his famous textbook that came out later, after I was a student, has this famous expression of simulation if everything else fails. So that's not an expression of great admiration, I think, for simulation in academia. And we have that same attitude we had in the United in the Netherlands, and we still have it in the Netherlands. So we have no simulation society. What we do have is we have an OWASP society, and we have a computer science society. I have been a member of both societies, but I quit the computer science society maybe 10 years or so ago. I'm still a member of the Operations Research Society. The funny thing is that the official name of that society is Society for Statistics, problem one. Statistics, that's a well-respected field. In the Netherlands, it goes back to the 17th century, to the golden century of the Netherlands. We had the first statisticians in the Netherlands using it for life insurance. So statistics, we have many famous statisticians. So St. Paul's, the Statistics Society, is the Operations Research Society. They used to have their own little newsletter, but it's low standard. And within the OR sub-society, you have the Simulation sub-sub-society. And that has no official status at all. So it depends a little bit on the activities of individuals. Like I was a chairman of a committee working on statistical design and analysis of simulation experiments. We had people from industry, from the Rotterdam Harbor, which at that time was the biggest harbor in the world. I think it now ranks...
What time frame is this you're talking?
1980, I think. And so we did... these guys... this is typical, my personal experience. People come to me, they have a simulation program. So they have already coded it. And now they run it, and they realize they don't know which scenarios to run and what to do with the output. And that's the time they will come to me and ask for advice. So at that time, we had a group of about 10, 15 people, including people from the University of Technology in Delft and in Eindhoven, and graduates from these universities who were working for this Rotterdam Harbor, ECT, which used to stand for European Container Terminus, but it's not European anymore, it's Chinese now. It's in the hand of a Hong Kong company, I think. And so they were looking at problems. The world economy was growing, so they had to expand the harbor. They had to add cranes for loading and unloading. They had to design how to stack those containers. They had a simulation model for that. That was running. And now the question, and what next? And then I came up with design of experiments and regression method modeling. And in the beginning, they didn't trust it, you know. I said, what kind of gimmicks are these? So what happened is they presented the results to management. And then management asked, what happens if you do so and so? And then in those times, they had to say, come back tomorrow. And we run overnight, we run this one run, and we tell you the answer tomorrow. And then I told them about meta models. So the next time they had the meeting, they could give the answer in 30 seconds because they just plugged in the scenario in the meta model, gave the answer. And then they still run it overnight, the simulation model, and validated the meta model. And it was successful. And so that was a project that lasted for a year or so. We published that in EJR, European Journal of Operations Research. I did similar things for PTT, our telephone, or what is the American company, Bell, eh? Bell Labs. So they had a lab, and that was more important sampling stuff. At that time, not very successful. So I worked with guys in electronic engineering, very smart people. And we published an article, and I called it Important Sampling, a Practical Failure? ? And then later on, people like Phil Heidelberger and Shahabuddin, etc., they improved this technology. And I think that's still an important sampling, is a really important topic.
Okay, so this is a research topic, but lack of a society must have affected, you know, research and lack of first sight, the spread of simulation and application in the early days. Was that the case?
maybe real life is tougher than academia. So in academia, you had the problem of no society for simulation, so no little respect, little prestige. At the same time, you have to realize that the Netherlands, I'm going back and forth between the Netherlands and the U.S. For me, U.S. is like second country home. Netherlands has several big international companies. Philips, that's very close to where I live, 20 miles. Shell, main headquarters in Amsterdam and The Hague and in London. Unilever in Rotterdam and Akzo Nobel in Arnhem. So these are big international companies. And I know that Philips is quite open about its research and applications. And they had a meeting, it's several decades ago, in which they surveyed the various OR techniques and statistical techniques they used. And it turned out the simulation was number one or two. If it was number two, then number one was statistics in general. And then came linear programming and that stuff.
Okay, so what department were you in at there? In your school, and how is this tying into operation research at your institution?
So that's my personal dilemma, so to speak. So I remember my supervisor was this Professor Max Oehre, the chess player. At that time, we didn't have departments. This may be hard for you to understand, Americans, but in the Netherlands, a professor was God. And so you had a handful of professors. They were the gods on earth. They were completely independent of each other. They did what they liked to do, which was hardly doing any international research. It was a very prestigious job, you know. And then we had in the 60s, we had this democratic movement in Europe, including Tilburg. Tilburg was occupied by students. It was called Karl Marx University for several months. So we are talking then about 68, big revolution, I think. And then after that, the world changed culturally, politically, and we had departments, and professors were no longer gods. So we had a democracy, and in the Netherlands, the Netherlands tends to be a very democratic country, by the way. Maybe only competitor would be Sweden or so. So the university is run by not the professors, but by all employees together, and students have a formal role. So then we formed departments. But because I was an assistant professor with this computer science professor, I started in a computer science department, very small. And there was also an OR professor, and he started in an OR department. And after 10 years or so, I felt more... And so all my mail... Not email, but we had regular copies. It was always a Jack Kleinen, Department of Operations Research. But the mailman knew that he had to be at the wrong department, you know. So he sent it to the computer science department. So after many years, I decided maybe I should switch allegiance, you know, and go to the OR department. But so I talked to the dean of our school. At that time, we had a dean. Before that, we always had deans, but not very powerful deans. That was part of the structure, no powerful deans. So I talked to the dean, and he said, well, politically speaking, you better stay in your own department, because the OR department is strong enough, but if you leave the computer science department, the level will go down, and politically speaking, that's not a good idea. So you stay in the computer science department. I tried the same game, actually, when I was about to retire. I said, maybe this is the right time to do a second trial. But then the world had changed, the money was most important, and somehow it didn't work out. So I stopped. I was teaching operations research from my two students in operations research. So I was not in the OR department, but I was teaching the simulation class to OR students until I had to retire officially at 65, and then they took one of the guys in their own department, not because he's a great simulation expert, because you have never heard of him, but it has to do with money. It saves money if you don't hire a person from another department. So that was the very basic reason, the only reason. So now simulation is taught by somebody who is not really seriously interested in simulation.
So since you mentioned you retired when you're 65, you know, history's going to know, how old are you today then?
November 22nd, I turned 72.
So you've been officially retired for 7 years, but
yeah.
then you got other appointments.
I got a part-time employment, first for 2 days a week. And now since this year, again, money is the cause of all evil, only for 1 day per week. And next year it will also be officially for 1 day per week. And then the whole contract probably will be terminated. That's officially, and in practice, I'm at the university every day, but taking a more relaxed attitude. I don't have to do any teaching, which I don't miss. Some of my colleagues say they miss student contact. I didn't learn much from my students. It's sad to say.
What about your graduate students?
I do have my PhD students. That's fun. So I still have, actually just today at the Winter Sim Conference, there were three or four. I had a graduate student a PhD student from Italy, Gabriella Dalino, from Sweden, Frederick Besson. And I talk about my French PhD student because his French supervisor was in the row behind me. I had also have Dutch students with a PhD. And my current student is from Iran. Funny thing is, I don't know how this situation is in the United States, but in the Netherlands, more than half of our PhD students are foreign. Dutch students
same thing.
And that's very sad. But that's another issue, eh?
That's another discussion.
Jim, what kind of additional questions do you have?
Well, I just like to bring up the same question that I had earlier, and that is, if you have any recollections of some of the early pioneers other than Toker, for example, did you have much interaction with Jeffrey Gordon? Did you have much interaction with Peter Lewis? With John Buxton Alan Clemenson? Mm-hmm. Any of these names or these people that you have recollections of that you
Peter Lewis I met several times, and when he was at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, he was my host for 1 day, I remember. And also when I was writing my book, probably Peter, I guess that Peter Lewis was evaluated the manuscript, because somebody suggested that I should include a discussion of the random number generator that Lewis, Goodman and Goodman, I think, was the generator. So I know I met Peter Lewis several times, and we had also technical discussions. Then I think none of the other names, of course, Alan Pritzker.
Mm-hmm.
I spent time when you were a PhD mm-hmm. student, and later on I came back to at least 1 month's visit, where we give this talk for about 30 people from all over the United States. I got all copies of his books mm-hmm. with his personal signature in it. Tom Naylor, I met many times. He's still around, but not in simulation. He's moved to politics, I understand. He wants to New Hampshire to break away from the United States. You know this?
Well, he had a different view in life. I know that, and he moved there. Yeah,
yeah.
But
yeah.
I didn't know what. He has some different ideas. Yes.
Yeah.
I thought he'd taken up an interest in divinity.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Perhaps
I haven't been in contact with him for a long time. So what else names did you mention, Jim?
Alan Clemenson.
I know the name. That's in England, eh?
Yeah.
Simulation
England.
Language.
John.
I must have met him, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really all. Are there any other individuals that you found... that you, in your view, had a large influence on the early development of the field of simulation? If you have any comments along those lines, any thoughts about that? People that you thought were particularly influential in the early days of the field?
Maybe Reuven Rubinstein, who passed away a few days ago. I was helping him to escape, let's call it that way, from the Soviet Union. I remember that when Jews were starting to leave the Soviet Union, that I got invited, I got a letter from him to help him get a visa for Israel, and I helped him there, and then later on he visited me, and so we were in contact for many years, until this summer actually he was passing through the Netherlands and he wanted to meet me for dinner, but I was on vacation in abroad, so I couldn't meet him, unfortunately, that day. So Rubinstein, that's a... And if I have an article together with him for the encyclopedia in ORMS that's edited by Saul Gass and some more people. So we are doing an update of that article. So many contacts with people like you. For how many years, Jim? Since the 70s?
Been a long time.
33 years.
Yeah.
34 years.
It looks a long time, but when we start thinking of the 50s and 60s, you know, we look at those as the old timers. We're getting too gray, too.
Yeah. So my first contact in the U.S. was with Clay Sproul, but you don't remember him. He didn't leave an impact. George Fishman, then. That was 67. And he's still around, and Phil Kivitz, they are still around,
yes.
But not active anymore, I suppose. What else are names? IBM. No, I met Lofty Sade, you know, on Fuzzy Logic. And in Europe, I repeat, you know, the European problem was and still is fragmentation, isolation. At the same time, it's great as a tourist, you know, we are now in Berlin. And you realize that Berlin is different from Paris or Rome or Amsterdam. I was in Germany a few weeks ago at a conference, and when we arrived, my colleague was in front of me, and he talked to the information desk in English, you know, asking for how we could find the classroom, the meeting room, and the guy didn't understand him, so I switched to German, and he was very pleased. And the Netherlands is a little bit exceptional. We always have been very much oriented toward Anglo-Saxon culture. So traditionally, our universities are German model, the von Humboldt University and the von Humboldt cultural ideas. So we are not French, like the French have their grandes écoles, which we don't have. In England, in the Netherlands, for example, we must accept any student who has a high school degree. We cannot do entrance exams. When I told that to a Russian visitor, I also had Russian visitors when we had the Soviet Union, he didn't understand. He said, well, what happens if next year you have double the number of students? How can you handle that? Because in Moscow, they have the strictest admission policies in the old Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So that's your number one university. In Norway, you have the same culture, so we have large cultural differences in Europe. At one point, that's exciting and interesting. I find it. Like, I speak four or five languages, you know, and it's a challenge, you know. I know, for example, that German for me is very easy. I speak German without thinking of it. Mm-hmm. France is a different story. I have to prepare my sentences in a way. And that's a cultural difference with the United States. So you are at a great advantage. You realize that? You have this big country with one culture. Maybe it's getting more and more Spanish.
Well, we got mixed culture, but we have the same language mostly. So there's that.
You have a mixed culture, you think?
Well, yeah, you go to the southern or west or New York City. There are very different people. Jim, other questions you may have?
Nothing else.
Anything that you think that you'd like to comment on that we haven't touched on?
Let me check my written note. I don't think so. We didn't mention the fact that computers were... Well, we mentioned that my first work on simulation, we had no computers. Then we had the... So my first exposure, real hands-on experience, was with second-generation mainframes, IBM 1620 in Tilburg, and IBM, I think, 1130 at UCLA. UCLA was sponsored by IBM at that time. And then I worked at IBM in 74. We had to close the doors when there were visitors because we were using digital equipment terminals. And they didn't have the blue collar. And now we are in the world of PC and the internet. And completely different world. I went to a panel discussion today on all this interoperability stuff, you know. Quite different from the kind of work we are interested in. A bit like a dreamland.
Yeah. Well, anyway, look at you.
Yeah, so that's the computer stuff. Like after the IBM, we had an English machine, ICL. Then we sort of merging with Eindhoven Technological University and Bayer Burroughs. So our last machine probably was a digital machine. Now everything is PC and supercomputers in Amsterdam used through the internet.
You never got involved with Simula or the people coming from the Norwegian Computing Center, did you?
No. I did get involved in supercomputers, if we are talking about computers. That's something that was not mentioned. I looked at an architecture that is now a dinosaur. You know these supercomputers produced by Cray and CDC,
yes, yeah,
with the what was it called technically? So anyhow, I'm thinking of it because I listened to Fujimoto today. That's his name, eh? Fujimori.
Yeah, Fujimoto, yes.
On parallel computing. So I looked at parallel computing for a while, which is unusual for me. It has nothing to do with statistics. And I realized that the simplest way to use these supercomputers was by using the parallel structure for parallel execution of different scenarios or replicates.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was published in Management Science too. At that time, that was obviously an eye-opener. The simplest way to use supercomputers was in that way, and not with this time warp stuff. And so people are still struggling with that.
Yeah. All right, so how about your list there? You said you were looking through your notes to see anything else you wanted to discuss.
Belgium, talking about our cultural walls, I live 10 miles from Belgium. It's a different world. They have different academic structures, different cultures. They are much more polite than Dutch people are. I worked with some people in Belgium, and with some there is no language problem. So I had some contacts with the university in Leuven, Louvain. I also had some contacts with the French university in Louvain-la-Neuve. But it's really amazing that Belgium might be a nice example. Belgium and the Netherlands, it's like UK and England. Same language with slight differences. Same culture? Well, no. Bigger difference between UK. So that's a barrier. Which more notes do I have? No, I think that's more than enough.
Well, we thank you very much, Jack, for spending time with us and to document some of the history here for our simulation archives. And I think it's worthwhile for us to learn about not only you, but what you know about other people. So we thank you very much.
It was my pleasure, Bob.